Right, good evening, and this evening we're exploring a discourse it's a discourse which was said in 1954 by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, by the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, and it was a discourse about the Torah reading this week. And it has not been edited by the Rebbe. So in other words, there's a team of people who, when the Rebbe said this on Shabbat, they remembered it by heart, particularly a rabbi called Rabbi Yoel Kahn. He could remember by heart what the Rebbe said in like 6 hours. And after Shabbat, he would write it down. And a team of people helped in like adding footnotes and stuff like that. Like the sources, so the Rebbe says it says in the Zohar something something, so they would put which page of the Zohar. Now some of these were given into the Rebbe, and he would check through it and change things around and add footnotes or take something out, but this didn't go through that process. So this is what's called a student's transcript. Now it kicks off, if you like, from a passage in the Sedra of the Week, in the written Torah. So we have this concept of the written Torah, which is the Torah scroll, providing a window of, or into, the spiritual dimension of life. And in this case, the part of the Torah which opens the Sedra the coming week on Shabbat, which is going to be read in synagogues around the world, is Mishpatim, which means laws. Last week we had the giving of the Torah, the giving of the Ten Commandments. And then Moses was on Mount Sinai, and God is now speaking to him over the 40 days and nights, and giving a series of laws. And these are the laws that it begins off with. Ve'eila ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. You see that verse 1. These are the laws which you should put before them. Now it's interesting, the word tasim lifneihem. One of the ways this is explained is that lifneihem, you see, before them. Now why does it say put laws before people? Shouldn't it say teach people? They're Hebrew words which mean teach people. So one way of understanding lifnehem is it's bipnimiyutam, to their inside. You have to get these laws inside the person. It's not enough just that they know the law as a law, you know, regulating conduct in daily life. It somehow has to go inside, because the law has many dimensions. And you can have something which on a practical level means one thing, and then on a spiritual level means something else completely. Now, it continues about this series of laws. Ki tikneh eved ivri. When you buy a Hebrew slave, or Hebrew servant, sheish shanim ya'avod, he should serve you for 6 years, uvashvi'it yetzei lachofshi chinam, and in the 7th year he should go out free. And then follows a whole set of rules concerning this Hebrew slave. And he is only supposed to work for 6 years, and if he doesn't want to go free, then there is some kind of procedure which it describes over here. But so we're not going into the details now, but we have the idea of a Hebrew slave. Now then it continues with another kind of servant. If we go on the next page, verse 7. V'chi yimkor ish et bito la'ama. If a man sells his daughter for a maidservant. Wow. That's, that is, I mean, the way that a person becomes a Hebrew slave might be through terrible impoverishment, or it might be that he committed a crime for which he has to pay back money, which he can't afford, so he gets sold as a slave. Here we have a case of real terrible poverty, and this man has had to sell his daughter as a maidservant. And it then tells us that he sells her to this family when she's like 7 or 8 years old, and she's there as a little maidservant, you know, carrying water from the well and stuff like that. When she reaches puberty, she has to either, the master or his son should marry her, or she should be set free. And if his master or his son marries her, verse 10, if he marries another wife, she'erak suta ve'onata lo yigra, he still mustn't decrease looking after her in the sense of giving her food, clothing, and intimacy, which is also her right in a regular basis, that there should be regular intimacy. It's just part of the rule of married life. And so therefore, this also has to be given. And if it's not given, then the master should set her free. Okay, so that's another kind of slave or servant of one kind or another. We've got a Hebrew slave, and we've got this maidservant. Now we go on to the third page, and we have yet another slave. Now this is verse 20. V'chi yakeh ishet avdo, if a man smites his servant, or et amoto, or his maidservant, bashevet, with a stick, umet tachat yado, and the servant dies, nakom yunakem, the servant shall be avenged. In other words, the man who hit him, the master who hit him, is punished because this slave died because he hit him. He's put to death, in fact, if he's... But, ach, im yomo yomayim yamod, if he doesn't die immediately, for a day or 2 days or 24 hours, he doesn't die, lo yukam, then he's not put to death, ki chaspo hu, because this slave does actually belong to him, whereas if anyone else hits the slave and kills him, even if he dies only after a week, he is put to death. Now that refers, according to Rashi, to a non-Jewish slave, a Canaanite slave. Okay, now if you're just learning the text of the Torah, these passages raise all kinds of questions about the social system in ancient Israel, and does it really mean that when the Messiah will come, there'll be these different slaves? And the answer is no, there won't. But here is the concept of these slaves in the Torah, and we now enter the discourse where the slaves are going to be translated into completely different concepts. We are the slave, or not. We are the one who have a relationship to the divine, to the infinite, and that expresses itself in a number of different ways, and we can be seen as either the Canaanite slave, or we're the Hebrew slave, or higher still, the maidservant. She's like the highest on this ladder. Or what about if we are really a daughter of God, like, which is... even higher. So that's on a completely different dimension. Son of God isn't mentioned in this discourse. Daughter of God is the most exalted level. So, now, in order to enter the discourse, which is this Hebrew text, which I'm going to be translating, attempt to, or summarize sometimes, and just, you know, like, sometimes just say it in English according to the passage of time. But we're now entering another dimension of the Hebrew text, of the Torah text. And the way that this would take place, typically, with the Rebbe actually being there and hearing him say a discourse, is that a special melody would be sung in order to open our heart a little bit, that we can make access to this discourse. And so that's what we do here, generally, despite my inability to sing. Yeah. Oh, ya, 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 yo, ya, yo. Oh, ya, 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 yo, ya. yam ba yam ba yom bam bom ha yin ya yam bo yin yam bam bom aho ya yedam ba yam bam bo ya yedam ba yam bam bom ha yedam ba ya yedam ba yo yamba yamba yambam bam oh ya yamba yambam bam oh yambam bo yambam bam oh ya 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 yamba ya yamba ya yamba yam oh ya ya yedam oh ya 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 ramba ya ya ba ya ba ramba yam ho ya 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 rambo ya ya ramba yam bambo ha ya ramba bamba yom ba ramba yom ramba ho ya ma yam ba yom bambo ha ya yam ba yom bambo ho yam ba yom. My understanding of that melody is that it's sort of reaching to the heights and then drawing something down into our world so that we'll be able to hear it. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem, and these are the laws that you should put before them. U'mefaresh behem shachaktuvim, and it explains as the verses continue. Ki tikne eved ivri, when you buy a Hebrew slave, v'chiyim ko ishet bito la'aman, when a person sells his daughter for a maidservant, v'chi yake ishet avdo et amato b'shevet, and when a man smites his servant with a stick, shehim hagimul sugim, these are the three types of slave. Eved ivri, the Hebrew slave, ama ivriya, the Hebrew maidservant, v'eved kanani, and the Canaanite slave. Vihine. Now, levad zot asher kol ha'inyanim sheyeshna begalya de Torah, apart from the idea that everything which is in the real, legal, the revealed part of Torah, in other words, the legal part of Torah, the laws, yeshnam gam kem besatim de Torah, also exist. Those same laws exist in the esoteric part of Torah. Hainu beseda hishtal shalut lamala, that means in the downchaining of the worlds, which extends higher and higher, that there is some expression of those teachings, whatever they are, they also exist on a spiritual level. Uvamele gam ba'avodah ruchanit benefesh adam, and since they're there on a spiritual dimension, they're also there in the spiritual service in the soul of the individual. There's another point. So in other words, any law whatsoever, any law you want to speak about, not to do this or yes to do that, all of these laws have got a spiritual other dimension to them, which we may know, which may be revealed to us in an easily accessible source, or it may be hidden away somewhere in a manuscript, or it maybe hasn't even been taught yet, but somewhere it's there. That's one issue. But then there's another issue. Hine otana mitzvot shein teluyot bezman. There are some mitzvot which depend on time, which epoch. Kumo mitzvot eved ivri, like this whole idea of these the Hebrew slave. Shenoheget rak bezman shehayovel noheg. You can't have a Hebrew slave now. Hebrew slave can only be in the time of the temple, the time of and then you would say as well that it's the Hebrew slave arises out of a very unfortunate series of events, such as that he stole something and he can't pay it back, or he's terribly poor and has to sell himself. So you would say that in the time of Mashiach, even when the temple will be rebuilt, you won't have the Hebrew slave either. So it's something which is from the past. So we must say, especially those mitzvot which don't apply today must have a spiritual dimension. Why? Because Torah is eternal. B'chol zman, b'chol makom, in every epoch and in every place. And these laws, the way they are in their physical form, they depend on time and they don't always apply. The im came behechrech loman, so therefore we must say she'inyan imelu yeshlam gam beruchniut, that these ideas must apply in spiritual terms. V'ha'inyanim kafi she'hem beruchniut, and those spiritual concepts heim betmidut, are eternal. Very, very interesting general statement about the whole nature of Torah law, that first of all Torah law has a spiritual dimension, and however practical it might be, might seem, and secondly, that those laws which don't apply in our time, for whatever reason, do apply in spiritual terms, and it's just a matter of finding what it is in spiritual terms in order to understand some dimension of what we are being taught by the Torah. So the Torah is always teaching us something, and it's teaching us something for us to apply, and if the practicalities that the Torah is teaching us seem not to apply, so then it must apply in a spiritual way, and then comes the question, what is the spiritual way, and where are we going to look in order to find it? Now, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe spoke, this was in 1954, 54 years ago, he was speaking with a background of six earlier generations of Hasidic teachers in his own Chabad school, going back to the beginning of Hasidism even earlier, another two generations to the Baal Shem Tov, and then the whole tradition of Kabbalistic thought, going back to the Zohar and to the Talmud, which, when a Kabbalist looks at the Talmud itself is a book of mystical teachings. And I remember meeting a very fascinating person once. Many years ago in Jerusalem, there was a man called Harav HaNazir, the Rabbi, the Nazirite. Rab David Cohen was his name. And he was one of the earliest Baalei Tshuva in, wasn't the earliest, but he was one of the earliest in the sort of modern world, who had in fact encountered Rav Kook and had been very inspired by him. He was a philosophy student, and he had become not just very frum, he'd become very learned, and he was very enthusiastic about Kabbalah, and in fact he became a Nazirite. And so as a result, he had long hair. And I met him towards the end of his life, and he had this long hair. His son is now a famous rabbi in Israel, Shah Yashuv Kohen, who I think is the rabbi of Haifa. So the Rabbi Nazir, it is said about him that he would have the books of Kabbalah open on the shelves, like open shelves like these are, but the Talmud would be hidden by a curtain. Now every yeshiva student learns Talmud and is very familiar with Talmud. The books of Kabbalah hardly anyone touch, but for Rav Nazir, the books of Talmud, they can be open. It's the Talmud, that's what people don't realize, the mystery which is in that, so that he would keep hidden behind a curtain. Okay, so therefore, what do these three kinds of servant mean in the service of an individual? V'zeh shemavua bidrush Rabbeinu Hazaken, and this is what is explained in a teaching by the first Chabad Rebbe called Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi. He died in 1812. And he wrote a teaching, in footnote 7 it tells us where that teaching is. Kol ha'bchinot de'eved ivri, v'am avriya, v'emed kanani, these three types of slave, the Hebrew slave, the maidservant, and the Canaanite slave, k'mo she'hem beruchniut b'avodah b'nefesh ha'adam, the way they are in the spirituality of the service of an individual to God. So I'll just take that opportunity to write something on my little whiteboard. How are you? That's lovely to see you. We're just in the first page, about halfway down. Are you okay? Well, at least you're still at this level. This is Judith, Diane.
Yeah.
And Anthony, Diane, and David, our host. Right, you met. No, that's what? David, and Nicole is our hostess. Yes. Yeah. Right, I'm just writing different levels of the soul. And we're starting on the lowest level, Nefesh, that's the lowest level of the soul, then Ruach, which is higher. Muddled up. Neshama, which is higher still. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama. And then, we'll use another color. Chaya, Yechida, are even higher. And so we're going to put them on the... In fact, Yechida is the highest level.
What about Bima and Shechina?
Sorry?
What about Bina?
Well, those are the Sefirot. Those are the divine emanations. And you've got a very good point. You see, there are 10 Sefirot, 10 divine emanations. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge, kindness, severity, and so on and so on. But here we're talking about the soul. So you can make certain correspondences between the soul and the Sefirot, and particularly the soul and the worlds. There are four worlds. So there is the world of action, you see the Asiya, the world of action, the world of formation, you see that. The world of creation, Bria, and the world of Atzilut at the highest level. So you can make those connections between these different aspects of soul with these different aspects of world. Because there's a sense in which the revelation of the soul within the person is the microcosm of all of existence. And so just as in the macrocosm, there are these four worlds. You see, beyond this is the infinite, above, off the page. So there's the infinite. And then we have Atzilut, which is really a divine dimension, a purely divine dimension. In fact, I, you know, casually say the word Atzilut, but Rabbi Shneur Zalman...
You want a pen?
You need a pen? Here.
Please.
But Rabbi Shneur Zalman couldn't say the word Atzilut, because he felt it when he said it. So he could just say Oiben in Yiddish, up there. And he wrote it Aleph Tzadik Yud with a dash. He would only write it in like an abbreviated form, because to him it was fire. You know, I can just say it, because to me it's a word, a concept. You know, I can explain a little bit, but it's all like...
He felt it.
That's right, he could feel it. He could feel it. That's, so we always have to recognize the difference between feeling and describing. You know, so a person might have learnt and so on. But then there are dimensions. In fact, it's going to talk about the difference between feeling and not feeling in the discourse. But there are intense ways of feeling. And so we're able here to write these terms without being knocked out of our... without swooning with ecstasy. Which... fact, it's a comment in today's in the book Tanya, which Rabbi Shneur Zalman wrote. There's a little passage for study every day, and the passage today, I think it's today's passage, talks about the concealment of the divine, which is there in normative Jewish practice. Like, you're doing something Jewish, you're lighting Shabbat candles. Now really, there's such a force of spiritual divine energy in that. If we were sensitive to it, a woman would light Shabbat candles on Friday afternoon and she'd faint with ecstasy, and you know, you'd have to call an ambulance, you know, oh, mum is fainted again. But instead she just sits down, relaxes, takes the Jewish Chronicle. So it says there that the intensity is hidden from us so that we're able to cope, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to cope. But of course there's some people from whom the intensity is not hidden, and they have to find a way to cope. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman was one of them. Okay, so he says, now let's see what he's going to tell us about this. We're at the words Uchlalut, Judith. Uchlalut Habiyur, which is 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines down, two words from the end of the line. Don't worry if you're not following in the Hebrew, because hopefully my translation does. But if you want to, it's 10 lines down, two words from the end of the line, Uchlalut. Uchlalut Habiyur Bezer, and the general, an explanation of this, Hu Alpi Masha Amru Chazal, it's according to what the sages tell us, Chamisha Shemot Nikula, the soul is called by five names, Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Yechida, these are these five names, the Chamisha Shemot Elu, and these five names, Heim Keneged, Dalet Olamot, they correspond to the four worlds, Atzilut, Briah, Yitzira, Asiya. Atzilut, emanation, creation, formation, action. So the five names for the soul correspond to the four worlds. Now if there's five, how do they correspond to four? And the answer is that we take two of them together. Chaya Yechida, these two at the top, Shebechlalut Heimchina Achat, they are called one. They are one. We're treating them as one because it says in the Zohar that they are neshama the neshama. The Zohar calls them the soul of the soul. You see, here's the soul. Nefesh, ruach, neshama. Finally, you get to neshama. That's the deepest level of soul. And then the Zohar says that chaya and yechida are the soul of the soul. So they're really on the same level. They are this exalted level called Atzilut. Right. Hine b'china zui keneged olam ha'atzilut. So that's chai yechida, that represents the world of atzilut, in the downchaining of worlds. V'gimel ha'b'chinot nefesh ruach neshama, and the three other aspects, going from below to above, nefesh ruach neshama, him keneged gimel olamot, they correspond to these three worlds, action, formation, creation, going upwards. Ach, but, Mitzadit kalalut ha'olamot, because of the integration of all the worlds. Hine gam mi shenishmato mibchinat nefesh ta'asiyah bilvad. Even someone whose soul is revealed only on the most simple level, the lowest level, nefesh. Klulim bo, they're included in him, or in it, in that soul. Gam kol sha'a madrigot, all the other levels are included. Shazer Shamru Hamisha Shemat Nikhula, and that's why it says there are five names for the soul, the whole neshama, neshama, every single soul. That's a rather interesting point, because the Zohar tends to see people on different levels. And Hasidic and other Kabbalistic writings as well. Whereas the thrust of Hasidic teaching is to say that within the individual who's on the lowest level, the highest levels are also there somehow. That's a general hallmark of the way in which Hasidic teaching approaches the world as a whole. in seeing the highest levels of spirituality being in some way accessible at any level, which for the Zohar or other Kabbalistic writings, one might see there's a division of holy and not holy. You know, this is good and that is bad. And the bad in Kabbalistic depictions is very bad. The Zohar has wonderful ways, and the Kabbalah of Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, Rabbi Moshe Kodavera, have wonderful ways of depicting things that are negative. But hidden within that, according to the Hasidic teachers, the Baal Shem Tov, and this chain of Rebbein, this chain of teachers, and other Hasidic teachers as well, hidden within the bad is good. And so that means that ultimately there is goodness in everything, and that's the great challenge of Hasidic perspectives on life, to cut through the bad and to in fact to see that the bad is not bad, it's good. And that's what's called, see, one stage is a little light pushes away a lot of darkness, so the light is good and the darkness is bad, and the light conquers it. That's wonderful, triumph of good over evil. But the other step is that the darkness itself should shine, that the evil becomes good, that a person, because they went through a stage of something very negative in their lives, and they were doing something very negative, lots of bad things happening to them, it's bad things they did even, they actually come to some kind of kernel of good which was hidden away inside that bad, and they discover some deeper dimension which is there. And so that's the Hasidic thrust. So even in this discussion about souls, of course you'd say any soul is very spiritual. Yes. But the way that the Zohar looks at it, there is a kind of hierarchy. And what he's just said is that even in the lowest of the hierarchy, in fact, every level is included. And he proves that from the wording of the Zohar. So it's like two faces of the Zohar, the regular Kabbalistic way of understanding the Zohar and the Hasidic way of understanding the Zohar. And so what he's revealing is this, what he calls the integration of the worlds. Now, there's a wonderful book written by the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Dov Ber, who passed away in 1827. And he wrote a book called Gate of Unity. And Gate of Unity takes the entire downchaining of the worlds in 52 chapters or so. He starts at the very beginning, the highest level of the infinite, and then coming down, down, down into the world, into the most simple, practical, physical level of existence. And the theme of the whole book is that at every stage of that process, there is what's called in Hebrew hitkalalut, integration, that everything is included within everything else. Enfolding. You know, the idea that you can take a hair, and in the hair you've got the whole DNA and everything else about the person, you know, so the way. So in every little bit of world, there is everything about the whole of existence on that deeper spiritual level, you know. So that kind of picture, and that's being alluded to here, that theme. Now, Okanege Dalit Prinat Elu, corresponding to these four levels, Yeshlam Gamkein Dalit HaPrinot, there are also the four kinds of slave, or four kinds of relationship with the master. The Eved Kanani, the Canaanite slave, Eved Ivri, the Hebrew slave, Amaha Ivriya, the Hebrew maidservant, Ubat, and the daughter. Right, so the daughter, she's at the top of the scale. Shezer ma shekatzu v'chiyim ko ishet bito. That's what it says when a man sells his daughter. See this idea of the daughter, brata de malka. Now this is a quote from the Zohar, footnote 11, which is actually from the Zohar on this week's Sedra. The daughter is the daughter of the king. The daughter of the king, an amazing concept. Shemagregat Bat, that the level of daughter, Brata de Malka, the daughter of the king, he bechinat Chaya Yechida d'Atzilut. She is the level of Chaya Yechida of Atzilut. So let's just put these four levels of relationship into our diagram. So at the very top, we have the daughter. And then we have the maidservant, women are really winning over him. And over here we have the Hebrew slave, or Hebrew servant. I mean, you could say that the whole arrangement with the Hebrew servant is not much different to working on a contract that you've got to work for 7 years, 6 years, and then Hebrew servant and Canaanite slave. Okay. So those are these four levels, like the four levels of the soul when we take Chai Yechida together, and the four worlds, right? So here we have these four things. Right. So he goes through this, that those levels, the Canaanite slave is nefesh in the world of action, the Hebrew slave is ruach in the world of yetzirah, formation, the maidservant is neshama in the world of bria, creation, and we've got the daughter right at the top. Now, Vehine, and behold, this is five lines from the bottom, halfway across the line. Vehine, behold, koshem shebeneshamot. Just as in the case of souls, yeshnam chilukim. There are differences, as mentioned, mitzad itchalkut shebeolamot, as there are in the differences in the different levels of world. Keinu gam b'malachim. So it is too with angels. Right, so we got worlds, souls, the different kinds of servant in the Torah reading, and then we've got angels. Shehem ha-mamutzayim u'shluchei ha-shefa. The angels are some kind of intermediary and channel of force through which al yadam yumshach ha-shpa lamata, through which the flow comes below. Shegam behem yeshlam chilukim. They also have the same kind of divisions, hanal, as mentioned, mitzad itchalkut sheba'olamot, because of the different levels of world. The malach sandal, the malach called sandal, probably the word from which sandals come from. Yeah. So this sandal, I think sometimes it's called sand, like sun. It may have another, like often these words have got on or ron at the end. Sandalphon, sandalron, something. So sandal is the Canaanite slave, and metat, then there's ron, right? So one doesn't actually say that word, but that is the next level. And there are also higher levels of angels. So there are different levels of angel as well, like spiritual channels. Vehine, behold, the last line. Kivun shetachlit yiridat haneshama lamata. Since the purpose of the descent of the soul below, he avodah lekono, is to serve God, over the page. K'maymar hazal, as the sages tell us, ani lo nivreti ela l'shamesh et koni. I was only created in order to serve God. Shezeu tachlit ha'aliyah shebishvila eta yirida. That's the reason why the soul is created, coming down into the world in order to ascend. Va'aliyah zu yal yidei gimel kavin. And that ascent is through three paths. Shalem ha'olam omed, on which the world depends. Shehem Torah, that study of Torah. Avodah, prayer. Ugmilat chasadim, and good deeds. Lachain, therefore, gam ba'ofen avodah. So therefore also, in the way of service, shebegimel ha'kavin, in these three pathways, Yeshlam gam ken chiluke madregot. There are also these different kinds of division. So we have here these four levels, and of which most of the time we're going to only be speaking about three of them. And that applies to the soul. It starts off from the Torah, because this is where it comes out of our section of the Torah reading, these three different kinds of slave. That is the window which opens, and we're then able to see something about the soul. We're able to see the anatomy of the soul, and the way that that relates to the anatomy, the spiritual anatomy of the worlds, and also about angels that I haven't even written down, right? And this is there in the three different dimensions of, so I'll draw a line, Torah, prayer, and good deeds. You see, if you're analyzing what we are actually doing in the world and how we are living at any particular moment, you could analyze our life in terms of Torah, prayer, and good deeds, and the way that each of those are expressed on these different levels. So you could look at Torah on these different levels, and prayer on these different levels, and good deeds on these different levels. Okay?
Why do we need the slaves, and the manservant, and the maidservant for this explanation for Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama?
That's a very good question. You see, you could just have a kind of a tract which explains it without any reference to the biblical text. So, for example, Rabbi Shneur Zalman's book Tanya does exactly that in its explanation of the nature of the soul and the struggle of the soul to serve God and the inner struggles within a person. It doesn't need the you could do it all without the connection with the biblical text, but we're actually trying to transform existence in some way. It's not only a matter of our knowledge, it is an effect that we're having on the world. And the fact that Torah comes down into the world in terms of the Torah scroll, and the Torah scroll is then read in the synagogue everywhere in the world. They're reading the same portion of the Torah. More or less always, not always, sometimes incidentally, they read something different in Israel to everywhere else. Depends on the patch of the festival. But it's just one out if that happened. Mm. And this, and not only that, but a child reads about the different, the maidservant and the Hebrew slave and this. You know, that it's something which goes right through the people on every level, on the simplest level. And the idea that that simplest level, which unites everyone, can then become a window to these spiritual teachings, which have got such tremendous energy, that is a way of uniting all the different aspects of the world. And so that's the important function of that. You know,
they can relate to that rather than reading Kabbalah and the mystical sort of translation of it, if you like.
It's an interesting question which way it's going. Do we begin over here with the Torah text and then go up? Or are we starting up and going down? And because we see this in the Torah text, here is this Torah text, which is very important in the life of the person. And, you know, let's imagine a bar mitzvah boy, you know, it's his bar mitzvah this week, you know, and he's going to be reading something about that. Now, what does that mean? And there's this whole illumination there at some point, which he might discover one day. It's some process which is taking place. It is like the way that spiritual teachings express themselves in the practicalities of life, in the actual learning of Torah or some dimension of that, our approach to Torah or our approach to prayer or our approach to good deeds. That's its integration. It's that word, hitkalalut, integration. It's that the highest and most spiritual dimension become integrated with every part of the person, so that there is, it's not just that there is like a spiritual part of the person. And then other aspects, well, that's normal. Normality is also the spiritual connection with God. There is nothing which is outside the circle of the illumination of the connection with the divine. And the process of connecting it to the words in the Torah reading are a process too. But it's a very good and important question that you ask. Okay.
And the obvious way around would be to start with the Chumash, with the simple meaning, and then find the deeper meaning. And not the other way around, not starting at the top and working down, because if you start at the bottom, then you start off with something which you understand, and you're able to read something deeper into it. If you start off right at the top, looking at concepts, five of these and four of those, you've got nothing to fix it to, which you completely understand.
Well, I mean,
and in other words, it's a good attitude to start with something which you completely understand the simple meaning of it, and then go and find the deeper meaning.
Well, I mean, there are a few responses to that, Anthony.
Yeah. In other words, I'm saying it's a better way to grasp it.
One is in terms of the chronology, the life of a person. See, in a person's life, you assume that they're going to start reading the Torah text at the age of five, Ben Chomesh Lemikra, says in the Ethics of the Fathers. At 5 years old, the child starts reading the scripture. So at that point, he or she starts reading about these different concepts in the Torah scroll. And at this point, you don't necessarily explain it in terms of, you know, this kind of complicated spirituality. But later on, at the age of 15, when a young man or woman are in the Chabad Lubavitch system, for example, are studying Tanya, and the Tanya is a very meaningful text to them, this Nefesh Ruach Neshama may actually be more tangible than the mysterious ancient quality of these slaves. Have you ever met a slave? No. What does it mean being a slave? How could a man sell his daughter to be a slave? It's actually easy to understand the mystical dimension.
It's happening all the time.
Oh, you're right.
Slavery.
No, yes. Judith is absolutely right. Whether it's from the Far East or the Eastern Europe, there are adverts in the tube about it. Yep. You're 100% right. And people tend to put it out of their consciousness. But you are right. That kind of slavery is a highly unwilling form, which is not what the Torah is writing about. I mean, the Torah starts off writing about a slave who is so contented working for his master, he doesn't even want to go free when the statutory 6 years have gone by, and he insists on staying with his master, right? So that's not what we're talking about in Saudi Arabia or something like that. Yeah, it's a different thing. But the point is taken that it's happening all the time, and one could say more on that, but we'll go back to our mystical endeavors and hope that somehow all the slaves will be freed, because we'll come to the level of the daughter. All right, we're up to chapter 2. Which is on Beit, which is on page Vav, page 6. Now, first of all, he's going to talk about mitzvot. See this? There's Torah, prayer, good deeds. Torah, avodah, gemilut, chasadim. First, he's going to talk about good deeds, in other words, mitzvot, and our relationship with the mitzvot. Then that is going to be interpolated with discussions about prayer. Then he's going to talk about Torah study, and that's going to sort of, you know, interleave as well. So we're looking through the perspective of either good deeds or prayer or Torah or a mixture of both, at these four, three different levels, and then the fourth level comes in. All right, so that's what we're going to do in the next few minutes with the help of God. Now, I think this is a fascinating discourse, and in order to get through it, I'm not going to say the Hebrew, I'm just going to say the English. Is that all right? You okay with that? Okay. But I'll tell you where we're up to, because I'm just reading it, and so if you want to follow, you can come. Now, the explanation of this in detail is the idea of the Canaanite slave can be understood from what we see in physical life, that a slave, there's a saying, a slave behafkeira nichale, a slave likes hefkerut. Hefka means absolutely, you know, like completely free, not in the sense of like some kind of noble freedom, but just to be able to do what one likes. A slave wants to do what he likes. He doesn't want to accept the yoke. He doesn't want to do his service. His wish is simply to do what he likes, which is the opposite of accepting the yoke of the master. The fact he serves the master is only because he's frightened of being hit with a stick, right? And that's why it says in the verse that we quoted, when a man hits a slave with a stick. So even when he doesn't actually hit him, nonetheless, the fact that there is a stick and there is a possibility that the master might hit him, this causes the slave to serve his master. So that means that even the fear of the stick has an effect on him that he serves the master, even though it's not actually the stick, but it's the fear of the stick. So that means that even if the master never uses the stick, whatever the slave is doing is only because of fear of the stick. And that, you know why he only serves. He only does what he's supposed to do because he's frightened of the stick, because he doesn't have any delight in what he's doing. He doesn't have any delight, he doesn't have any will, he doesn't have any intellectual enthusiasm, he doesn't have any feeling in what he's doing. Now, we're here talking about a Jew keeping mitzvah. And the Jew keeping mitzvah, why is he keeping mitzvah? Is he keeping because he's got feeling in his heart, or because he's got delight, or because he really wants to passionately do it? No. The reason why he does it is because he's afraid of the stick. And through this we can understand what the spiritual dimension of the Canaanite slave is. He doesn't enjoy, it's a Jew who doesn't enjoy, he doesn't have any ta'anug, any delight, any will, any feeling in service of God. And the only reason why he serves God is because he's afraid of the stick. Mm. Now, what's the stick? It's very amusing. There is a concept in the Talmud, Yirat Ha'onesh, fear of punishment. And you could say that there are some people, the only reason why they do something is that they're frightened what will happen if they don't do it. You know, kind of, if you like, superstitious fear. You know, what will happen if I don't do that? Oh, yo, so we must do it. But the Rebbe doesn't refer to that here. He refers to something else, the fear of the stick. You see, the stick is something from outside oneself that hits you and forces you to do something. That is a spiritual dimension which is outside us. The idea of the stick is hit'orot tshuva, an arousal of repentance, because of chuzim ha'elyonim. There are spiritual revelations, like a chuz means an announcement. So there's a spiritual announcement which our soul is sensitive to. And the soul thinks, oi, I better do this thing. That's what's forcing the soul to do it. It's not because of its own effort. It's not because it's worked on itself and it's come to a deeper spiritual level, or it's come to a deeper perception or a realization. It's something beyond. And the effect of that thing beyond hits the soul, and it has an effect on the soul. I remember the Six-Day War. The amazing effect that the Six-Day War had on many, many Jewish people. Absolutely incredible. And I remember one very close friend of mine. So he was in my class at school, Jewish boy, always top of the class. And as we grew up, and he and both of us went to university, he became extremely left-wing, very negative to Israel, and very, you know, totally remote from the whole, you know, general Jewish cultural thing, living with a non-Jewish girl. You know, we would talk about, I myself am born in Israel and I have great sympathy anyway with the whole Israeli thing, even though I'm brought up in England. And we would like talk about this. He was very against it. No, you know, international. So then came the Six-Day War. So I remember I was living out of London at the time. So I phoned up my friend, see what he thought about. And his non-Jewish girlfriend picks up the phone. Where's my friend, you know, whatever his name is? She says, oh, he's gone to Israel to fight. You know, in fact, he didn't fight. He was picking oranges while other people fought. But I was just so struck with that transformation. You know, there was suddenly this thing, bang, you know, he's doing, it's like this.
The stick,
exactly. And there's so many things like that which sometimes we're aware of and sometimes we're not aware of, that there's some real, God forbid, a loss in the family, can have a tremendous positive spiritual effect on people in an amazing way. The man who comes to shul to say Kaddish, you know, for his father who's passed away, unfortunately. But he doesn't normally go to shul. And it's not only that he's coming to shul to say Kaddish. There's a whole process taking place. Something has happened and there's some kind of spiritual interaction. So that is what the Rebbe, you know, this kind of thing, and also sticks which we don't see, but which maybe the Rebbe could see, in the life of an individual. Because when a person would come in front of the Rebbe in Yechidut, like at 2 o'clock in the morning, the Rebbe's looking at that person. It said he could see where their soul was at the very beginning of creation. Mm. And the Rebbe could see all the different aspects and dimensions of that soul. So that's the... So it could be that because of fear of the stick, he serves God all his life. Not only does he serve God in the middle of the page, he never transgressed. He's an impeccable Jew, keeping all the mitzvah, never transgressing what is called in Tanya a beinoni. The intermediate man in Tanya, or woman, is a person who keeps every single mitzvah they're supposed to keep in thought, in speech, and in action. They do everything. The only thing is, he's careful all about this. He's careful with his speech, and with his action, and with his thoughts. And he doesn't allow himself to get into any inappropriate desire, anything. He is a completely, so to speak, it looks very spiritual person, very frum person. The word frum is sometimes translated feel rishus, veinig mitzvahs. A lot of bad and little good. However, that's the initial letters. Mm. But that is, I mean, you know, because words can be used and they actually represent the opposite, unfortunately, or they have problematic dimension. But here we mean a person who sincerely keeps the mitzvah. The only thing is, the only reason why he doesn't, because of the fear of the stick, and that makes him into what is called a Canaanite slave, because in himself he would like to be Hefka. in himself. He would like to do anything, but he controls himself. Very strict self-control. And because of his self-control, he keeps himself on the straight and narrow all the time, does what's right. And so why does he keep himself on the straight and narrow? Why is there this self-control? Because of the fear of the stick. There is something or other which is holding it all in place. It's actually a very admirable quality. I mean, you can't consider this as nothing. There is an achievement. I remember an academic that I knew. And I was visiting this academic, now he's passed away, Alav Shalom. Extremely English person. Very, very English. And he lived in Kensington. And I was an undergraduate at that time. And he invited my group, like our year, he invited us to come and visit him on a Sunday morning, something like that. Now, he was a religious man. But, you know, there's religious, what within the context of university. So he offers me some milk tea. So I must have, you know, maybe lacking a little bit of control myself. Maybe I raise my eyebrow. You know, something or rather, you know, the milk won't be Jewish milk, Chalav Yisrael. So he said, don't worry, it's Chalav Yisrael, it's Jewish milk. Couldn't let the side down. So I was really impressed. You know, this couldn't let the side down, this English concept of, you know, you're going to live according to a set of rules. Well, you jolly well do. You know, that's, you know, how does the Boy Scout take down the tent? You know, like, you don't leave anything in knots if it's supposed to be untied and rolled up. You keep, you know, don't let the side. So in other words, there's some kind of something which is holding the whole thing together. Well, that's a wonderful thing.
It's the rules, isn't it? Rules
and boundaries, and the fact that one accepts those rules and boundaries, I think one could say that's because of the cruise. You know, that's because of this, like, spiritual dimension. It may be some other thing. It may be some other quality which we might come across here. But there is this, the way that there is a structure to the person's life, and they're keeping all the mitzvot, they're a religious Jew, an Orthodox Jew, and that's very wonderful, but in terms of spiritual progress, which he may well have done, and that's why he didn't let the side down. You know, I don't want to say that he himself is not at some exalted level. We can't measure each other. But just in terms of, an apparent attainment. Now, there's a concept in the Talmud, a very intriguing concept, that Rabbi Gamliel had a slave, a Canaanite slave, whom he treated as if he were a Jew. And when this slave passed away, he sat shiva for him. And he said, my slave is not like other slaves, he's kosher. Right? There are quite a number of other things. This slave, he wouldn't sleep under the table in the sukkah, he had to sleep in a regular bed, not under the table, because it's not kosher to sleep under the... So this slave was like a very frum slave. Even though he wasn't Jewish. Although a Canaanite slave, incidentally, has the status of a Jew in many ways. A Canaanite slave has to keep Jewish law, which is an interesting thing, although he can't put on tefillin. He has to keep all the negative mitzvot, but not the positive mitzvot affected by time. Now, there is... So this is actually a very high level, which is called a Canaanite slave, but he's like the slave of Rabbi Gamliel, who is very Jewish. I mean, this is a very, very orthodox, very traditional slave. The only thing is, it doesn't come from excitement and inspiration. If this departed academic will forgive me using that idea, it's because you don't want to let the side down. You know, like it's something else. It's not the inspiration that keeping this mitzvah is the most beautiful way of uniting with the divine. it's because there is this heavenly announcement that we are not conscious of, and that somehow is enabling us to keep on the straight and narrow. But then there's another kind of slave who is more like other slaves. He is lower than the level of a person who keeps all the laws. He doesn't keep all the laws. And there are many different levels of this. The best one is that he only transgresses occasionally and only in a very light way. And that means that the fear of the stick is not enough for him, that he shouldn't do any transgressions, but it's just he doesn't do bad things and he doesn't say bad things, but his thoughts are very negative. And then there's someone who does bad even in his speech or his action. But because of the fear of the stick, which is sometimes thinking about tshuva, about repentance, he regrets. And that's the whole thing, that he regrets. So he does that, but he regrets. And then he goes lower and lower and lower, different kinds of, getting lower and lower, as it were, with this Canaanite slave, as regards the whole idea of action. So this is the lowest level. That's the Canaanite slave. And, right. Now then, chapter Gimel, we have the Hebrew slave. That's the next step up. We're going to stop soon. The Hebrew slave... Now, wait a minute. Then he connects this with prayer. Now, prayer can be that you're just saying the words of the prayer because you have to say the words of the prayer. So that's this level as well. The prayer is simply because you have to do it. So he's linking good deeds. The good deeds are because you have to, because of this stick. This like subtle inner stick. And the words of the prayer are saying the words of the prayer because you have to. You know, it says in the code of law that you're supposed to pray, so he prays. It doesn't feel...
Is that the action?
Yes. Yeah, that's all on this level. Yeah, all in this level.
But it creates his rule, if you like, or the stick creates the action.
Yes.
Doing prayer.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So he does the right thing in terms of his mitzvah. He does the right thing in terms of prayer. It's firm. It could be firm, but it's without enthusiasm. Mm. And at a lower level, it's not even firm. His actions are right, but his thoughts are bad, and then you can have bad actions as well, sometimes, or bad actions much of the time. So it goes lower and lower. Okay. Gimel. The next level is the Hebrew servant. So then you have the Hebrew servant. Here we have a concept of a servant where he's got feeling. This servant has got feeling. And when he or she prays, there's a lot of feeling in the prayer. But it doesn't change the inside of the person. You know, you can have feeling in prayer. And an hour after the prayer, you can be the same coarse person that you were before the prayer. But the time of prayer was a time of inspiration and enthusiasm. And so at that point, you got excited and enthusiastic. But it's quite possible for there to be negative characteristics as well. Now, it's interesting, but it hasn't been changed. Now, this is somehow compared with the role of these slaves in a home, that what the Canaanite slave does very simple things. The Hebrew servant goes out to the market and buys food, and he brings it home, and the maidservant cooks the food. So the Hebrew servant goes and brings the food to the house, which is like the enthusiasm in prayer. But it's not cooked. The person's not transformed. Their inner qualities are not actually transformed. And then he goes, then he goes to, one second, and so in prayer, that's the concept of enthusiasm, and then he starts talking about learning Torah. Now, learning Torah, there are two ways of learning Torah. One way of learning Torah is what's called the Migros, and the other is called the Be'ian. Learning Torah Lemigros means that you're just simply learning basic, very simple, basic understanding of this page of Torah. To learn with Iyun means real analytical thinking into the Torah and exploring it, a completely different dimension. So he compares that to the two slaves. The Canaanite slave is like the person who is learning, just he has to learn it. Whereas, and so he learns Torah. Whereas the Hebrew slave really puts himself into it and he's getting involved and he understands it and all kinds of different ideas. And in the same way, his prayer is something which is enthusiastic. But it hasn't changed his inner nature. Now we go to a higher level. The higher level is the level of the maidservant. And the level of the maidservant who actually takes the food and cooks it and transforms it. Now there's a very interesting statement about cooking. That the physicality of the food is the physical dimension, and the taste is the spiritual dimension. So the fact of putting the effort into cooking, I could just imagine the women when they were hearing that, oh, but that idea of cooking the food is bringing out a spiritual dimension within the food, and that is what is happening on the level of the maidservant. That's the deeper level than the neshama. And the same in prayer, the prayer is at a much deeper level. It's an inner transformation, it's real inspiration of the person. It's not just enthusiasm, it's inspiration. And when the person stops praying, they're a different person. They're a different person, and in fact, he talks about quite mystical levels, the way in which the person, when they pray, they are somehow transforming the world. They're connecting their prayer with the divine in a very intense way. It looks as if this maidservant actually represents a Hasidic Rebbe. That's the quality that comes out from here. There's a very, very intense spiritual process which is achieved through the prayer in an incredible way. And also the Torah, the power that the Torah has to ascend to higher and higher levels. And then we have, so there we have these three dimensions of good deeds, prayer, and Torah according to these three different levels here. And then comes the fourth level. And that's at the very end of the discourse. And the fourth level, the daughter, it's something else. It's a let's just take if we take the very last page. Va'omnom, so it's the very last page. Va'omnom bechinat bat, but the daughter, brata de malka, the daughter of the king, the princess. That's Chaya Yechida, the very essential level in Atzilut, the highest level. That means that these three lower levels, which are lower, these different servants, but we've come here to something absolutely higher. As we say on Yom Kippur, Im Kavonim, Im Kavodim, God judge us, whether as your children or as your servants. And the idea of being children of God, that means this higher level. And that means that all what we've spoken about before, even on the highest level, it's something where the person feels themselves. You could be very spiritual, but you feel, I am being spiritual. Whereas there's a point beyond that altogether, which becomes like the total. You see, he's explained the prayer actually in terms of the ladder of prayer. The very lowest level is the beginning of the prayer, Hodu Lashem Kitov. Then you come into the Psukah de Zimra, Ashrei. Then you come into the Birchot Kriya Shema and the Shema. And here you come to the Amidah. Now when we say the Amidah, it's an incredible thing. We're facing Jerusalem, our feet are together. It's as if the words of the prayer are pouring through us, as if we're a channel for the words of the prayer. We say at the beginning, God, open my lips so my mouth should declare your praise, as if our lips can't open by themselves, and it's God who is making it all happen. So there is this total surrender and this total bitul. Bitul means complete self-abnegation. And this is the quality of Moshe. Because Moshe brings a higher dimension. In order to get this dimension, we need Moshe. It's Moshe who gives us this selflessness, which we wouldn't achieve by ourselves. But Moshe helps us achieve this, and that's what it means. These are the laws you should put before them. You should put these laws into the pnimiyut, into the inwardness of the soul, and bring out that inwardness. And so that is the process of Moshe. So therefore, it is through the connection with Moshe that we're able to draw some kind of inner self-abnegation through all these different levels. So that whatever level we're on, we're that in a real way. And that's a very interesting thing about Hasidic teaching as a perspective on the Kabbalah. Because there's one way of understanding Kabbalah that one is always trying to get to a higher level. You know, so people see the different sfirot, oh well, I have to climb to this level, climb to that level. And there are some books which are written in terms of that, going higher and higher. There's a Hasidic teaching that the point of truth is being at the middle of the level where one is on. One might be a Canaanite slave. In fact, one might be a rather coarse kind of Canaanite slave, not the higher level of Canaanite slave. We might be five levels down. But nonetheless, we don't fool ourselves. And that level of truth, that center point, is a center point which connects to the center point of all the other levels. That's what Moshe is able to give us. And Moshe is the guide, the teacher, the Rebbe through the generations. Moshe is like the first Rebbe, and then we have down through the generations. And what our Rebbe is trying to do is grant us this quality, that we can come to this center point, like the center of gravity of our being, the central level of whatever level we're on, so that it doesn't make any difference if we're on a higher or a lower level. That's not the issue. The issue is to be what we really are, mitanemes, in a true way. And then whatever we do, including sometimes we do something that's not right, that's not the end of the world. We are trying to improve, but it's not because we do something wrong that we're causing our whole destruction. No. Because eventually, we will improve. We're able to get to the point where we're able to understand, okay, at this point I can't do that yet, but you know what? Tomorrow is another day, and eventually tomorrow is going to be better than today. And we move forward. And in that way we bring transformation to this whole system, including all the worlds, which will eventually become the way they should be. A revelation of God.
In this life,
yeah,
we can do it all, the transformation in one life.
Well, we can get to the point of truth, I believe, in one life, and whether on whatever level we are, and we can connect the world to God through our service, so we can draw godliness into the world at our level. And in a sense, we are on the threshold of a complete transformation of the world. And that's what the Rebbe taught. Yeah, the Rebbe taught that we are just at that threshold. And so our awareness of being on the threshold transforms our view of the totality of existence. It gives us a sense of freedom and empowerment. That the little things that we manage to do, maybe it's just a fight inside our own thoughts.
But I think Iksit Mundi is disempowerment, cum laude.
That you are Axis Mundi, that you are the...
No, Iksit Mundi. I mean the end of the world
The Iksit Mundi.
Yes.
But we're not talking about the Iksit Mundi, we're talking about Axis Mundi being the pivot of the world. And bringing the world. The time of Mashiach is not the end of the world, it's the beginning.
Well, you could say Amen Afar.
All your lovely paintings will be on display. At least.
Incinerated like everything else.
Nothing will be incinerated.
Yeah,
very interesting, this idea of knowing where you are.
Mm. Yeah. Chapter 13 of Tanya.
Reminds me, in last week's Sidra, when Yisro, the wise Moshe, came along and told him to appoint was it say Anshe Choyel Men of Hala, people who are clever. They told them to appoint all these people of as judges who hate gain, Sonepotse, Anshe Emes, men of truth. Right? But they should be judges over thousands, over hundreds, over fifties and over tens. So and that, talking about your thing of being true to yourself, the Kotzke, he asks, if it says that they hate gain, that they're not bribeable, these judges, then he said, if they're not bribeable, then obviously they're going to be interested in the truth. So why does it say Anshe Emes?
Uh-huh.
So he said like this, if you appoint people, one judge over a thousand, one judge over a hundred, one judge over 50 and one judge over 10. A judge is going to turn around and say, how come you appointed me over 10 to Moses and the other guys over 1,000? You know, he's not all that much better than I am. So he said, that's why it's written in the Torah, Anshe Emes, men of truth, that a man who's truthful about himself, he knows his own position, he'll turn around and say, you're quite right. I'm good enough to be a judge over 10.
Uh-huh.
Right, somebody else can be 1,000 because he's better than me. So he said, that's why you need Anshe Emes. Doesn't mean men of truth who are interested in the truth, but men who are true, they're honest about themselves.
Beautiful. Very nice.
You reminded
where
me
did
of
you read that? In Amud Emes or in a another collection?
I read it in a Sefer by Rabbi Nachum Mendel Mikotz,
which Sefer? What, Theosophic Kiddush?
I don't know. If I remember, I'll bring it next week. It's a safer, it's got...
Is it according to the Parshas?
Yes. It's got the Kotzke's Rebbe in the front part. Sorry?
The Pshisharev. The Reb Simcha Bunim of Pshisharev.
Yeah, Reb Simcha Bunim of Pshisharev is the first half. And he's in the second half.
Oh, interesting. I'd like
you
to
haven't
see
that.
I don't. It must be some modern edition where they like re-edited it.
Yeah, it's a modern edition where they've taken excerpts where there's some different from.
Yeah.